This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
To see the Dead Sea Scrolls, typically a person would have to travel to the Middle East to see them in museums near where they were discovered. But right now, there's a Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., and that's our focus on today's program, as we're talking with Christopher Rolston, a professor at the Department of Classical and Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. It's very convenient for you that the Museum of the Bible is just 20 minutes on the metro on the other side of the National Mall.
Yes, indeed it is. It's very convenient. In fact, traveling from GW's Foggy Bottom campus doesn't even require that I switch trains. I simply get on the blue line or the silver line for that matter, and I take it right to the Museum of the Bible's metro stop. So it's really nice, and I've availed myself of the close proximity on a number of occasions to visit the museum.
Well, unlike most Museum of the Bible visitors, you can actually read these scroll pieces that are in Hebrew or Greek or Aramaic. So what do you see when you look at them? What are you looking for?
I'm looking at a number of things. I look at the preservation of the manuscripts. How well preserved are they? How large are they? Most of the pieces which are part of this exhibit are small, of course, for various reasons, including the fact that it would be really complicated to move and then to attempt to display some of the larger scrolls, such as the Isaiah scroll, for example. It would just be too difficult to do. Then I'll read them. Of course, these are unpointed texts, so this is centuries before the Masoretes had developed a system of pointing that occurred basically between 600 and 1000 AD. So these manuscripts are much older than that, so they're not pointed with the traditional Masoretic pointing because they antedate that. So it's really nice to look at these beautiful texts hailing from such an early period.
Can people appreciate the scrolls without being able to read them?
I think so. I think that just seeing the manuscripts and then reading the signage, and the signage is really well done. The exhibit as a whole is very well done. The Israel Antiquities Authority and the Museum of the Bible worked together in collaboration on this, and it's a first-class exhibit. And so even if someone can't read the scrolls, they can get a sense for it because the signage is good, the context is good. It definitely conveys the importance of these really amazing discoveries, hailing all the way back to 1947.
You mentioned the Isaiah scroll. This Isaiah scroll is actually on display in Jerusalem now for the first time in a number of years. Of course, there are many people who can read Hebrew in Jerusalem. I think one of the values of the Dead Sea Scrolls, why they're so important and get so much attention, is in many cases they're exactly the same as a Hebrew text today that's translated to English.
Right. They're very similar. That's right. So with regard to some of these manuscripts, indeed, they're very, very similar to the Masoretic text. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are. Some of them are different. They're very similar to what we would consider to be the forelog of the Septuagint, for example, or the forelog of the Samaritan Pentateuch. So there are some texts that are very similar to the Masoretic text, which we have even to this day. But some are quite different. The beauty of these is one can read them for oneself and make decisions about the contents. You know, we can look at the textual variants. So this is just a panoply of wonderful material.
What intrigues you most about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
All sorts of things. One of the things that I think is quite important about them is that sometimes we see textual variants in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That is to say, Masoretic text, which we have the most copies of, hail from basically 1000 CE, 1000 AD, or a few decades prior to that. These scrolls are much, much older, and so they've been copied far fewer times than the Masoretic text from the Middle Ages. We have textual variants within the Masoretic text tradition as well, but I should say a few words about textual variants. So not all manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible are actually identical. And we don't have the forelock. We don't have the autographs. We don't have the actual copies the author wrote. So oftentimes what we have are copies of copies of copies. For the Masoretic text, like the Leningrad Codex or the Aleppo Codex, these, as I say, hail from about the 10th century CE. And the Dead Sea Scrolls basically push us back more than a millennium. One of the fascinating things is one can look at and compare some of the readings.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Christopher Ralston, a professor at George Washington University in the Department of Classical and Near Eastern Languages, Civilizations, and we're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, a few of which are currently on display at the Museum of the Bible.
Not all manuscripts are the same. Let me give you a concrete example that'll sort of flesh it out. In the Masoretic text of 1 Samuel, Goliath is said to be 6 cubits in a span tall. We know from the Septuagint, so the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, that there were some different understandings of that or different readings. Most of the manuscripts of the Septuagint give Goliath's height as 4 cubits in a span, for example. Josephus actually gives Goliath's height as 4 cubits in a span. So the question becomes, how tall actually was Goliath? Among the Dead Sea Scroll manuscripts of Samuel is one which actually gives Goliath's height as 4 cubits in a span, thus corresponding with what the Septuagint manuscripts mostly have, and also corresponding with what Josephus had indicated in his summary of the books of Samuel. This is where the rubber meets the road, as it were. How tall was Goliath? People do want to know. That is to say, inquiring minds still want to know how tall Goliath was. Based on a constellation of evidence, with the most weighty being that of the Samuel manuscript from Qumran, it can now be stated that Goliath was 4 cubits in a span. That is to say, the Dead Sea Scrolls coming from the period before the Common Era and Josephus and the Septuagint all dovetail and reveal to us that Goliath was 4 cubits in a span. So about 6'6". The Masoretic text has him at 6 cubits in a span, so about 9'6". There's nothing crucial in terms of anyone's faith about the height of Goliath, right? This isn't a crucial point, but it is sort of interesting, and it's one of those cases where we can look at the material from the scrolls, and it helps us ascertain what the original writer of Samuel had written. That is to say, it seems to me really clear that the original author who composed the books of 1st and 2nd Samuel, authors, had Goliath's height, and for what we know as 1 Samuel 17:4, is 4 cubits in a span. It's a minor thing in many ways, but it's really quite fascinating. That's the sort of thing that the Dead Sea Scrolls can do, is they provide us with some really early textual material that often will refine the readings that we have in the Masoretic text. And again, let me reiterate, we have lots of manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible and for the Greek New Testament, even more. No two manuscripts are alike. So we have to weigh those readings to see which seems to be the thing which the original writer wrote. And in this case of the height of Goliath, the Dead Sea Scrolls manuscripts in combination with the Septuagint manuscripts, which we have, and Josephus, all dovetail to give us the height of Goliath. There are all sorts of really fascinating textual variants.
So the modern translations of the Bible in recent years have updated the height of Goliath then?
Well, I wish that were so. What they have pretty much universally done is dropped a footnote in there, which says the Dead Sea Scrolls have 4 cubits in a span, and they'll usually refer, if it's a good study Bible, to the readings in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, done before the time of Christ. And so that's about the most that they do. I suppose that this is one of those times when translations don't wish to be critiqued for something like this. So I wish they'd actually, the translators would actually, the translations would actually put the four cubits in a span reading right up in the translation itself. Normally, though, they drop it into the footnotes.
A lot of modern Bibles then do have Dead Sea Scrolls in their footnotes.
Absolutely. In fact, what I would say is if someone has a Bible and they're reading it for the purposes of studying the text in depth, if that Bible translation doesn't reference Dead Sea Scrolls readings, which are the earliest and often the best readings of the Bible we have, then that's probably not a good translation or a good study Bible to use if one really wants to study the text in great depth. One wants a Bible that actually lets you know about that textual variant. Again, we wish we had the autographs. We wish we had the original copy that the original author had produced. We don't. We have copies of copies of copies. And so the Qumran material basically gives us a window that's more than a millennium older than what we had before Qumran. And from my perspective, what we want to know is what the original author wrote. And the Qumran texts give us the ability to get so much closer to the original reading.
Well, Dead Sea Scrolls research continues now, even 80 years after they were first discovered. One of the items in the news recently was about a project at Groningen University where they used AI to date the scrolls. Some of the original dating was confirmed, but in other cases, it appears as if the scrolls should have been dated a little bit earlier. Should AI be used in Dead Sea Scrolls research?
Right. I think that AI is a wonderful thing. I also think it's a double-edged sword. And I don't think that it's the panacea that some think that it is, at least with regard to paleography. So in this particular article, which was published in Plus One, as you indicate, by scholars from the Groningen School, in essence, they looked at Qumran manuscripts, mostly a grand total of 30 manuscripts. And most of them were from Qumran. They looked at manuscripts which had been dated by carbon 14. And in essence, they used this machine learning tool dubbed ENIC to attempt to refine paleographic dating. What I would suggest is that AI can do many wonderful things, but paleography really isn't one of those things.
Christopher Olsten, a premier paleographer, is department chair and professor of biblical and Near Eastern languages and civilizations at George Washington University. We will continue our discussion of AI, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Museum of the Bible in our next program. I have a link to the story I wrote for Christianity Today on this topic at our website at radioscribe.com. There you'll also find breaking news videos from the Israel Antiquities Authority and information on Artifacts, our biblical archaeology news magazine. That's at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.